welcome to the Semiconductor Insiders Podcast Series. The goal of this podcast is to bring semiconductor experts together to get to the truth about the matter at hand. We'll get right to the point and not exceed 30 minutes of your time. If you have a topic you would like us to cover, please post it on semiwiki.com and we'll get right to it. Good morning. My guest today is Jeff Critton. Jeff is VP of Sales at Corrigan. Jeff and I are friends. We've known each other for some time and worked together before. Jeff, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Dan.
So first, let me ask you, Jeff, and I ask everybody this, is what originally brought you to semiconductors? You know, how did you get into the semiconductor industry?
Well, that goes back quite a long time. So I think it was 97 when I started for Cadence. And in 96, early 97 as well, I was working in Toronto, Canada. And I'd been out there a number of years, and the weather there is kind of like Minnesota. And so I decided, I want to move south and enjoy the sunshine. And so I applied not only to Cadence, but a bunch of other companies as well. But Cadence made me one of the best offers with respect to immigration and everything else. So I decided to take that. I ended up at Cadence for about 22 years. So it was a good decision overall. And I was pretty happy with it. And of course, the California weather is pretty spectacular.
Yeah, I was born and raised here. I've traveled around quite a bit, though, but I don't think my wife and I will ever leave California. But you know what's interesting, Jeff, is like myself, you have a master's degree, but your master's is in physics. What brought you from a master's degree in physics to EDA?
It was interesting. At the time, Cadence had just bought a company called Alta, A-L-T-A, and they had a bunch of digital signal processing technology. And so my master's was in physics, but it was really more in the mathematics department. And I focused in, my thesis was on deconvolution of room acoustics. So I knew a lot about audio and video processing. So they brought me on to sort of be a subject matter expert in that space at the time.
Well, it worked out quite well. You know, I've been in EDA most of my career, and I never left. You know, EDA has been a pretty bumpy road, but I don't think I've ever seen a better time to be in EDA right now. You know, I mean, EDA is booming, double-digit growth. I mean, so many people are buying tools and such, and you know, it's just an amazing time to be working out in the field here.
So, yeah, it certainly is.
So let's talk about prototyping and emulation. You know, I spent actually a lot of my career in prototyping and emulation. I worked for a company that did one of the first emulators, maybe 30 years ago. And I do follow the business. I've written a couple books about it, specifically on prototyping. But so what brought you to prototyping, and specifically what brought you to Corrigan?
Well, I was looking for the next step in my career path, and I interviewed with a number of companies. And Corrigan had a pretty unique idea. And so I had sold, Cadence, the prior QuickTurn products, Palladium, and Protium. So I was pretty familiar with that view of things. And so their view was quite interesting. They had picked up a design team that they acquired via Synopsys, I believe. And that team was originally at QuickTurn all those years ago. So they have a lot of expertise in-house. And they wanted to get to market with a unified platform. Because if you think about it today, all the vendors, you look at Synopsys, Cadence, they all have the emulation. With Cadence, it would be Palladium, and then they had the prototyping machine, right? And so that would be like HAPS for Synopsys, and ZeBu would be the emulator. They wanted to come to market with one platform that can do both emulation and prototyping. Now, there's some features that are not as robust, but they've done a great job to bring that to market, and they priced it at more of a prototyping price point. So you can get a lot of the capabilities you'd normally see in an emulator, which generally is quite a lot more expensive, in your prototyping solution. And so I thought that was a great idea. So I thought, the customer should be able to really resonate with it.
Yeah, it's interesting that the emulation and the prototyping business, what came through acquisitions in EDA, right? So Synopsys bought HAPS and ZeBu, and Cadence bought QuickTurn, and I forget where they got their prototyping, but they bought a company or a couple companies. And Mentor even, they bought an emulator company a long time ago, and then they just recently bought a prototyping company. So, that they kind of bought, through acquisition, got into this business. So it wasn't really natively and developed from the ground up. And I worked with S2C EDA, and they had, prototyping, and it was just interesting how the evolution and how we got to this point. But, you're right. I mean, if you ask why people prototype and why people emulate, it's kind of the same answer, different phases, it's not really a competitive thing. Prototyping and emulation are tremendously important to companies these days. I mean, what market segments do you see, that you speak to the most right now?
I mean, we're kind of attacking, all semiconductor market spaces, but we're getting a lot of success in companies like people with doing microprocessor cores that are, customizable. So we have a lot of success there because what they want to do every time they customize that core, they have a ton of software regressions to run against it. And so this platform really allows them to scale with their software developers as well as their, hardware engineers.
Yeah, that was the number one reason that I experienced was, and this was recently, it used to be people emulated and did prototyping to bug fix, because they wanted to get their designs through for silicon and stuff. But lately, for the last few years, it's mainly software. People want to develop their software in concert with their hardware. Apple is one of the companies I used to work with, and boy, I tell you, they're big emulators and prototypers, and that's why they get their software out, immediately with their chips, right?
Yeah, it's great. I mean, they send their netlist off to the fab, and then they can go start software development right away.
And I think software is probably the biggest burden in semiconductors right now. When I joined the industry, there was one software guy for every 10 hardware guys, and now it's probably 10 software to one hardware, or maybe even 100 to one hardware and software. I'm not sure.
There's a lot more software guys, that's for sure.
Yeah. So the interesting thing that I experienced was that, a lot of the guys use the same FPGA, right? So, even emulation, some emulators have their own chips, but a lot of them are based on FPGAs, specifically Xilinx. But, so everybody uses the same FPGA. How does that work on the competitive landscape?
Well, if you think about Xilinx's latest incarnation, I think it's the VU19P. So that has a lot of capabilities you can take advantage of in your software stack, right? So when you're doing compile and mapping. And so CoreGen has their own unique software stack to do this. And so we've taken advantage of all the capabilities in the VU19P, which includes, I think it's 4.5 terabit per second of I/O multiplexed over 2,000 pins. So what that gives you, if you have a design that you partition across multiple FPGAs, you can take those 2,000 pins and that kind of high-speed I/O and interconnect those two FPGAs, but you also have enough left over from a bandwidth point of view that you can go capture signals as well, which gives it that sort of emulator type of capability. So really, the FPGA technology today is, compared to a couple of years ago, is just amazingly far ahead, and I don't think there's much of a need to go ahead and do custom silicon.
Yeah, they're getting big. They're getting big too. I mean, one of the challenges that we used to experience was partitioning design. So, just buying a prototyping board. I think even Xilinx has their own prototyping boards. With one chip on it, or you see bootleg prototyping boards out there. But you have to be able to. Most people have to be able to cut up their design or partition their design. And so, prototyping turns out to be, a serious amount of software, right? I mean, you guys have a partitioner, I would expect.
Yeah, we have auto partitioning, which really helps folks because they don't have to do any kind of manual intervention.
Yeah, that's one of the biggest challenges. If you have blocks that fit on each FPGA, that sometimes works, but generally the size of chips that we're seeing today do not now, nor will they ever fit on one FPGA, right? SoCs specifically.
Yep.
And what about debug? You guys have a debugger? Most, debug's a big deal, right?
Well, the key there is the ability to capture the debug signals, right? And you can do that without having to go through a big recompile process. And each of the FPGAs has, I believe, 16 gigabytes of DDR4 attached to it. So you can fill that up with any kind of signal data you want to capture. Obviously, it's not an infinite amount of storage space, and there's a couple of emulators out there that offer a lot more. So depending on the design, you could really sort of offload your emulators that you have on premise today and put most of them on something like this, which frees them up to do the more complex problems where you're really having a hard time doing debug and you need to capture a ton of signal data.
So, in your mind, what's the difference between prototyping and emulation, and how do you do it in parallel? As I said, most companies have a separate prototyper and a separate emulator. One thing unique about your company is you kind of have both. So, give us a little more color on that.
So in my view, the difference is the emulator is generally used by the verification team looking for bugs and running regressions, right? And pulling all that data together. Whereas the prototyping boards, typically what I'm seeing is the software developers are really using those more so than the hardware guys because they're trying to run a stable netlist at speeds of 10 or 20 megahertz so they can actually boot an operating system and make sure everything is okay.
How fast can you go on an emulator these days? Is it single digit or are they in double digits as far as megahertz?
When I was doing that work with my old company, the most I ever saw was around the 1 megahertz level. Things may have changed though, but it's been a couple of years.
Right, and what about prototyping?
Prototyping, we're seeing 10 megahertz up, depending on if you're
Wow,
partitioning and everything else.
that's actually very good. So what's the end game here? So once you have prototyping and emulation, in sync, what else do you guys look at, or what's in the future here?
Well, we're planning to support the next generation of the Xilinx product, and that will really revolutionize things even further with just amazing specs over and above what the VU19P does. So we think, we're going to carve ourselves out a nice space in this market, such that companies can come to Coragen, have a unified platform. They can lower their support costs because one platform is easy to support than two. It's readily available. They'll be able to get more capacity for their existing budgets, so they'll be able to do more verification and more software development, which is a good thing for everybody. So we see a pretty strong future in this particular segment and slice of it.
Yeah, when I was in prototyping, I saw over 3 or 4 years, I guess it was, maybe it was 5 years, but I saw the capacity of FPGAs just double and double. Is that what we're seeing again, or is it going to continue to increase the capacity?
Yeah, it certainly looks that way. It's best to talk to Xilinx about that, but from what I can tell, that's definitely the track that they seem to be on.
Yeah. So how big of a design are you have you had experience with? How do
Yeah,
you count it? Do you count it by gates?
our offerings go all the way from a PCI Express card that fits in a standard workstation. I think you put three of those in there, but each card supports about 50 million gates. So smallest granularity, about 50 million, and then that scales up to a system with essentially 32 instances of that, and so you're going to end up with over 1 billion gates overall capacity. And you get that kind of capacity, and you're going across 32 FPGAs. The best performance we've seen is the 6 to 7 megahertz range, which is still pretty good for that kind of capacity.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, for that many FPGAs.
And if you don't need that many, so it's great to have a 1 billion gate emulator, but not everybody's running a 1 billion gate design. So we set it up in such a way that you can put it in your local data center. Doesn't need any kind of special power or cooling. You just plug it into 120, and you can have up to 32 simultaneous users. It only has one workstation as a front end, so you don't need 32 workstations or anything. And each user would then get a 50 million gate capacity. However, you could have one user using 4 or 5 FPGAs, another one using, 2 or 3. So you could have any kind of mix and match that you need to get your job done.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Yeah, one thing I've seen is that a lot more people are doing design starts, and these are systems companies, not normally the chip companies, and I'm sure you're seeing it as well. But these system guys, they have a whole system to emulate, right, or to prototype. So they need all sorts of interface cards and all sorts of outside stimulus. So you said mentioned PCIe is certainly a popular interface card. But do you guys have a lot of these daughter cards? Are they daughter cards?
You could call them that, yeah. And so what we've done, there's an industry standard in that space, and we have the industry standard connector. And so if you wanted like SD or HDMI or UART, you just use a board that supports that standard. And off the top of my head, let me just give this some thought. Those are the FMC connectors.
Yeah. Got it. I was trying to think of that term as well. Well, that's excellent. So before we finish up, do you have any additional thoughts? What do you see going on in the industry? We've just had such a boom year, last year, and I guess this year may have started out a little bit slow, but I see another pretty good year. Certainly double digits, and EDA is doing quite well. I know the EDA companies, traditional ones, are doing pretty well with the prototyping and the emulators, but do you see some pretty good growth this year?
Yeah, I do, especially for us, just given the unique positioning in the market. Typically, emulator sales cycles, if you look at historically, somebody will come out with a new platform, typically Cadence and Mentor in the same year a lot of times, right? And that'll drive a lot of sales of new technology, and then it'll sort of slow down a lot in years 2 and 3, and typically in year 4, there's another one that comes out. But that cycle is kind of slow in a lot of ways, right? Because they're missing a whole, if it's FPGA based, they'd miss a whole generation of an FPGA.
Sure. But you know, those emulators are millions of dollars, if I remember correctly. You know, what price range are your products? I mean, you know, what can you tell us?
Well, at the very, very high end, I mean, it's going to be the low millions as well for a billion gate system. One thing they have to consider too is just the operational expense. So, for example, you know, some of those systems consume just an enormous amount of power, whereas ours doesn't. And then just the ability to house it in a sort of non-compliant data center space without the massive cooling that you normally have to have. So I remember one customer I had years ago that I sold a number of systems to, and they were concerned that they were so heavy they'd fall through the floor. So they had to have structural engineers come and make sure the load of support on the floor was good enough to support these things. Then they had to spend a couple hundred thousand dollars on water to get in there for water cooling and everything else. So this system is much more simplified. I mean, you could really, you know, the billion gate system, I think, is about, it's a half height blade rack. And so it's about 3.5 feet tall, I think. And so you could even slide it under your desk if you wanted to, you know.
But generally speaking, these some of them, a lot of them are desktop systems, right?
Yeah, they're all like, so our single FPGA system, you can have a desktop version of that. Our quad system is a desktop version if you want that as well, or it can go in the blade server. And then once the quad goes in the blade server, you have eight of those, which gives you the 32 FPGAs. And so you could slowly build that out if you didn't have the full capacity requirements on day one.
That's amazing. Well, great. Hey, that was good information. Thanks, Jeff. Hopefully we can touch bases with you again later this year or next year and see how things are going. You know, I'm a big fan of new technology, and if you guys did really integrate prototyping and emulation, boy, that's going to be a big deal. That's for sure.
Yeah, thanks, Dan.
Yeah, especially on the desktop, because you're right. I've been in data centers with emulators, and they are huge. So anyway, all
Never
right.
even saw the NVIDIA
All
picture.
right.
That's a pretty interesting one. Anyways, thanks a lot for your time.
Yeah. All right. Take care.
Cheers.
That concludes our podcast. Thank you all for listening and have a great day.